Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Podcast Network.
You're a trusted brand. You don't put the Pope in a Speedo, and you don't take the cream out of the Oreo. You change one little thing, and you're going to force a conversation with the audience they don't want to have.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 218 for the week of September 10th, 2018. I am Secret Chef Ingredient David T. Cole, and I'm here with Carrot Adjacent Trauma, Sarah D. Bunting.
Mom, what's a FAP?
Screaming Child, Tara Ariano. And Sex in a Puppet Horse, Alan Sepinwall.
It just smells that way, okay?
Oh, I wish I didn't have to do the intro this week instead of laughing, but I do. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another week of Extra Hot Great, and welcome back to our guest, Chief TV Critic of Rolling Stone, Alan Sepinwall. Hi, Alan.
Hey, guys.
Yay! That was quite a moniker you picked for yourself. And of course, it refers to Kidding, the Jim Carrey / Gondry collaboration for Showtime, which premiered this past Sunday, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Losing track of what day it is because I'm old. So Kidding follows Jim Carrey's character, Mr. Pickles, beloved children's television presenter, who is facing a personal tragedy in his life at home. I was concerned, frankly, about this show, and it lived down to my expectations in terms of I felt trying to do way too many things, at least in the first episode. Alan, did you find that was a problem, and did things even out for you, if so, after that?
I've seen four of them so far, so three past the one that's already aired, and I've got very mixed feelings about it. I think it does a lot of things well. I think Carrie is great. I think Frank Langella, who we heard in that opening clip, is really, really good. The two episodes that are Michel Gondry directed, I liked a lot. But it feels like every other Showtime half hour. It's kind of like there's this quirky formula that they have. And it just seems no matter what the topic of the show is, no matter who's running it, anything, it always kind of works out that way. And it's kind of exasperating, despite the fact that I think Carrie's really good. But it just seems like a show that's afraid of being about what it's about. So sometimes it's about overwhelming grief, and sometimes it's just, hey, crazy things are happening at the puppet show, or crazy things are happening, you know, with Catherine Keener's marriage, and, you know, my taste for that is less.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It held my interest. We also watched the first four, which were provided to critics, and, I mean, it did feel very scattered. It felt like it definitely needed to look in the mirror and take one thing off. And that one thing was what's going on with Catherine Keener's marriage, because we already have a bad marriage with Jim Carrey and his very boilerplate rotten nag wife, Judy Greer, who also gets a crappy beta male, you know, stepdad figure. Like, that's also a very well-worn TV trope and movie trope at this point, with the Justin Kirk character that we get to know more after the pilot. But yeah, it's it, And I also felt like the show couldn't figure out if Mr. Pickles is a man-child or if he's just really good at his job or if he's suppressing what's going on with him or like where it wasn't clear to me where he is mentally. And this starts right at the beginning of the pilot when he comes up, he guests on Conan. And Danny Trejo was the first guest who's still out on the couch and he's wearing a necklace that says P Hound because of course he is. And Mr. Pickles asks him what the P stands for. And then we find out later in the episode, like, that's not a bit. He really didn't know what it stood for. It's like, this is a man in his 50s. Like,
yeah,
come on. I know he works in children's television, but Jesus Christ.
Well, yeah, that was one of the first notes that I took that I really like Carrie's performance and I really like Langella's performance, but the writing of Mr. Pickles is like, I don't buy that he would be this alienated from everyone else's like social and emotional realities. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to go that direction where he's like this man child who has been cocooned by what he's chosen to do for a living, then get more into the behind the scenes of doing that without being sort of like performatively sour about it. Like the moment where you find out that they actually are fucking in the horse costume, spoiler, that's when I was out, that I was like, I like this cast. I want this to be something that I care about, but there's just too much going on and none of it is new enough. And I hadn't thought of it in the way that Alan said, that it was so close to that sort of Showtime half hour apparent formula. Mm-hmm. But it is just like this purposefully repellent set of circumstances and people that I was like, I mean, I love Justin Kirk, but I can't do it.
Yeah, I think that the Mr. Pickles issue is my biggest problem with the show. Ultimately, Frank Langella in the first episode gives a big speech about how there's Mr. Pickles and there's Jeff and never the two should meet. But I don't know that the episodes I've seen gives me any sense of who the non Mr. Pickles version of this guy is.
Yeah.
Every now and then there's like a hint. Oh, you know, he does get everything. He recognizes that it's important to stay in character because he doesn't want to disappoint people who love Mr. Pickles. But a lot of the time he just seems like this oblivious man child, like Sarah said.
Well, and there's also that particular quote points up a problem with the Frank Langella character, which is that despite Langella's best efforts, like a lot of the things that he says are true, but they're phrased as such truisms that I don't believe that that's how people talk, because it isn't. I'm not sure why these bromides are being delivered in what's supposed to be an emotionally realist scenario. So
yeah, the other thing that happens is as the episodes go on, we find out that Frank Langella's character has a plan for what to do if/more likely when Jeff completely loses it and can no longer be Mr. Pickles, and how they're going to keep their empire alive, which we find out is like a $119 million merchandising behemoth. Which, you know, Sesame Street is also, and other, you know, even public television children's products are. But what the big reveal at the end of the pilot is that Jim Carrey is brother to Catherine Keener's character, and Frank Langella is their executive producer and their dad. And so he does a lot of things that make sense for an executive producer, but not for a dad, like particularly later on in the run when he's encouraging Jeff to like go out on a date with one of the ladies who like sends him dirty pictures. It's like, that's your kid. Like, it's gross. You know, like there's a way to have the conversation that's like, you know, you need to get past your failed marriage and get back out there that isn't look at these photos. We'll curate you a list of the perviest ones. Like, that's your dad. It's disgusting. Yeah. Like, sorry.
Yeah.
That's a weird choice to me. I feel like they wanted to try and have it both ways and be shocking with that character and be, you know, maybe emphasize how disconnected Jeff is from his work by having this guy, you know, constantly trying to sell him out, and it's his dad versus just some guy who's his producer. And it's like, I don't buy that a father, even one who's this self-interested, would act that way. I mean, Alan, you watched ahead. Do you agree?
It's not ideal, and I think Langella is the one providing most of the laughs in the show, because they mm-hmm. give him these sort of arty from the Larry Sanders show, incredibly profane things to say.
Yeah.
And they're fun. There's a bit in, I think, the second or the third episode about an otter puppet that I would like to quote 10 years from now and see if anyone recognizes it, but it's very funny. But yeah, no, it's, unless they're willing to address like how Jeff Pickles came from this guy, and maybe that's the idea, is from having such an emotionally manipulative and twisted dad, he retreated into this character, but there's not enough evidence of that early on
yeah.
for it to be worth the dissonance you're getting here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. The puppets are cute. When we get the pill bug intro in the first episode that Catherine Keener's character makes, it's extremely cute.
Yeah.
I would like to see the actual, like, Mr. Pickles, whatever the name of the puppet show is. I think Jim Carrey is really good in those segments. Like, mm-hmm. I completely buy that he would be this 30 years beloved kid show superstar.
Yeah, the song that he sings about feelings, which is apparently, you know, the cornerstone song of the franchise, was perfectly done. There were a lot of well-observed moments. Like, of course, he drives a PT Cruiser. with the wood panels. So I was mm-hmm. like, yeah, that's about right. But the rest of it was just, you know, he's next door to his old house having shaved one strip of his head. And I'm like, I can't. I don't think I can.
Yeah.
And with hasn't this, Judy Greer graduated from being the nagging wife?
Yes. You would think. But I mean, apparently TV has a bottomless need for them. Like, they just keep popping up. It's Busy Phillips and vice principals all over again. Like, this is what you want to do? Good Lord.
Yeah.
I haven't been saying very much because I'm sick, but I do have a terrible theory I'll run by you. And that
oh, I want to hear this.
All right. Spoilers aho, fun ahoy for, I don't know, episode 3, maybe 4. In 3 or 4, like, there's some weird stuff that happens. There's like this scene. Jim Carrey's worried about something in the show that kids might emulate, and it's laughed off. But then, like, there's a flashback where a kid actually does, like, go over a barrel in a waterfall to emulate the show. And I think in the same episode, there is a scene where all the kids that are sort of around Jim Carrey's surviving son, like, they've all looked him up on Wikipedia and all the rumor stuff. And they're like, there's this weird story going around that he was basically like a CIA spook or a black ops guy. And he's like a world-class marksman once upon a time. So that's actually true. And it sort of syncs up with how much time he spent on the show. And his new persona, Mr. Pickles, was his dad's way of making him cope with all the shit that happened back in whatever. Oh. War thing. So he was normal up to that point. He goes sort of like army crazy, and this persona is created at, that's like the sliding doors point where Jeff Pickle sort of ends and Mr. Pickle begins. And which is like a throwaway line in episode 3, but if anything sort of like justifies why Mr. Pickles is the way he is that it's all like the family is all in on this as a way to, like, this is the only way he could survive. That is like really out there. That would be like,
which, you know, also ties to the Truman Show in a way. Yeah. So
it is sort of like that, except it's from within instead of from outside kind of thing. You know, it's like,
right. Yeah, sure.
Anyways, that's my stupid crackpot theory. Now spoilers are at an end, and I can't talk too much. We're going to barge.
Wow, we haven't heard the whole thing in a while.
Yeah.
Well, I would tell you guys to let me know if Dave's Dave Festo comes true, but it doesn't sound like either of you is going to keep going with it. Is that true? Or are you going to keep plugging?
I think I might, just for Carrie.
Okay. Yeah.
It is only half an hour. I mean, it's got that going for it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it held my interest, so I might continue watching it, but like, it's also about to be fall, like everything is coming back, so I don't know. It doesn't see it's not unmissable for me at this moment, but it's intriguing, even in its weird like gaps and deficiencies. Like, it's an interesting experiment, but I also don't see it like taking off or maybe getting a second season.
Yeah.
It's time to go around the dial. Everybody's going to...
Thank you, Dave. Perfect intro. I'll go first.
Oh, we're just going to go with it? All right.
Yeah. People know. I watched the first episode of You on Lifetime. This only one has aired so far, premiered on Sunday. This is the stalker drama from Greg Berlanti and Sarah Gamble, and starring Penn Badgley and someone unknown to me previous to this, called Elizabeth Lail. The premise of this is that this girl, Beck, goes into a bookstore. She has like a very standard meet cute with this guy, Joe, who works there. And they kind of, you know, have like banter about Paula Fox and blah, blah, blah. But the twist is he's a stalker and he's a total creep. And so it's, he gets a lot of voiceover, and so we go almost right from the very beginning into his perspective on everything that's happening, starting with like, she reaches up to get a book off the top shelf and he's like, oh, you're not wearing a bra and you want me to notice. And it's like, not necessarily. Weirdo. And then escalates from there with him. You know, he looks her up. She's got a huge social media footprint. She's very, does not practice good information hygiene at all. And is, you know, makes it easy for him to find like her siblings and go back for years in her history and find out like shit tons of stuff about her because none of her accounts is protected in any way. He finds where she lives because she doesn't have location posting turned off. He calls in a fake gas leak so that he can let himself in posing as her boyfriend and like rifle through her stuff in her actual apartment. And then she comes home and his voiceover says, and I wrote it down because I thought it was so good. He hides from her in the shower and says, I've seen enough romantic comedies to know that guys like me are always getting into jams like this. And I feel like that's sort of the show in a nutshell. It's like, it takes the perspective of this guy who thinks he's doing everything fine and that what this woman he does not know really needs is for someone like him to protect her from herself. And, you know, to him, it's like, this is what guys do in rom-coms all the time. And he's right. Like, the difference is in rom-coms, it's, you know, the girl likes the guy, so it's not creepy. It's really interesting. I didn't really have any expectations going into it. And I also, especially after Gossip Girl, did not necessarily think that Penn Badgley had this creep of a character in him. But it's good. Like, the pilot is very intriguing and grabby and like nothing I've seen before. The female lead is not the best actor. She, at least in the pilot, I haven't watched past there. Is a little bit too like smiley on all her lines, regardless of what the scene is supposed to make her do emotionally. But Lou Taylor Pucci is great as her shitty boyfriend who has a lot of family money and is trying to get his artisanal soda company off the ground. There's a cumin soda that he's trying to make happen. It's very delicious. Funny. And Daniel Cosgrove, who, if you listen to Sarah and me on our Again With This Beverly Hills 90210 podcast, he plays Matt, who has just arrived on the show at the point where we've arrived on 90210. He's an awful, abusive neighbor, still has all his hair from 90210 era. So good job to him. But yeah, it's really good. It definitely, like I said, it's a grabby premise and I think really well executed and feels very confident. Something like this, I don't think you can sort of half-ass it. And they really go for it, making this guy like scary and awful. Alan, did you watch it?
I watched the first episode of it and I could tell like, okay, this is well executed and I do not want to watch another second of it.
Fair enough. Sarah, I think you might like it.
I'm going to try it.
This might interest you. Good performances. Law and Order mainstay Red Rogers is Beck's like thesis advisor or something. She's also an aspiring poet, and that's like part of what he finds interesting and also contemptible about her, Joe, rather, not the thesis advisor who's just trying to hit on her because, of course. But yeah, You, it's on Lifetime Sunday nights at 10, and then it looks like they're repeating it a whole bunch at least this week. So if you missed it and you don't have the Lifetime app, you can probably catch it again in a re-air this week. And for my plugs, I will just mention the Better Call Saul recaps are still going. Sarah and I are trading off weeks. This week it was me with season four, episode six, Pinata. So check those out at previously.tv.
Mr. Alan Sepinwall.
All right. So Friday is going to be a crazy day in the world of TV if you cover it, because there's BoJack Horseman comes back, American Vandal comes back, Amazon has a new show called Forever, and Hulu has a new show called The First with Sean Penn that they're dropping all the episodes of. I want to talk about American Vandal, because that first season of that show really snuck up on me. I was not expecting anything from it. I didn't even watch it before it debuted, and only came to it later when people kept bugging me about it, and they were right.
Same.
It was brilliant. It's hilarious, and also kind of moving. It's like this dead-on parody of true crime documentaries, but also this really touching and well-drawn teen drama, and I didn't think they could possibly duplicate it. They kind of do and they kind of don't in the second season. It's now a year later. Peter and Sam, the documentary kids from the first season, are now famous because American Vandal has wound up on the Netflix in their universe, so they wind up going to a private school in Washington State to investigate a serial vandal called the Turd Burglar, who is doing all sorts of shit-related crimes at the school. And they investigate it, and the chief suspect winds up being this really weird loner kid named Kevin, who confesses to it but may or may not have done it. And what's weird is you would expect in a second season they would lean more on the comedy, and it's much less funny, and I think deliberately so. It's much more towards the sadder side of what worked so well in the later episodes of season one. Like, the chief suspect is a very well-drawn character. I feel like I've met a million sad kids like him. There's a bunch of stuff like that. It's just, despite the fact that there's all these poop jokes, it's not nearly as funny. And part of that is because the main suspect isn't as inherently comical as Dylan was last year. And part of it's just because Peter and Sam are not in the show as much. And Peter's narration is responsible for so much of the humor in the show. But I watched all 10 episodes, or 8 episodes, I think, in a rush, and I really enjoyed it. In some way, I think as a mystery and as a story, it works better than the first season. But if you're expecting the laugh riot of finding out who did the dicks, it's not at that level this time.
Is it because dicks are funnier than poo?
No.
Possibly. I don't know. Should we get a ruling on that?
Absolutely not.
Dave says no.
Yeah. Poo is number one funny thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Dan's right. I was excited at the idea of Peter Maldonado talking about turds, and he does it. He just doesn't do it a lot. I think because Peter and Sam don't really have an emotional arc this year like they did last year, the show sidelines them a lot in favor of the story. Because you just think about the number of different ways in which Peter talked about the dicks last time and how funny that always was. There's just less of that this year. It's still funny. It's still really good. I still recommend it. I just want people coming into year two to be prepared for less of a laugh riot than they got the first time.
And for your plug, Alan?
All right, so I got two plugs. The paperback version of Breaking Bad 101, The Complete Critical Companion, my book with essays on every single episode of Breaking Bad, plus some interviews with Vince Gilligan and Bryan Cranston and people. That comes out in October. That's available for pre-order now. And I have a new book coming out in January that I co-wrote with Matt Zeller-Seitz called The Soprano Sessions. It features, like the Breaking Bad book and like Matt's Mad Men book, essays on every episode. But it also has a new collection of interviews that we did with David Chase, where we went deep on everything about the show, up to and including the ending. I think it's the best thing that either of us has ever written. I'm very excited for the world to see it. And that is also available for pre-order now at Amazon or wherever fine books are sold.
We'll link to that in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. Sarah D. Bunting.
The Sopranos is how I met Alan, actually, and American Vandal will be the lead topic on The Blotter Presents next week. But first, The Forger's Masterclass is my topic this week. I was settling in to watch an episode of The Big Painting Challenge, which is basically the Great British Paint-Off. But I saw an even more alluring program in YouTube's right rail called The Forger's Masterclass, in which a notorious art forger turned Sky Arts presenter John Myatt challenges three pupils each episode to paint in the style of a famous artist and then crits the results. And it's really good. Like, it's not, you know, great art, but if what you want is something soothing, like British joy of painting, this is your jam. Myatt was content to paint fakes for fun until a friend slash client of his started selling them as the genuine article for genuine article prices. So he's extremely knowledgeable about his subjects and what makes them unique. He's not trying to teach anyone how to forge an actual like Edward Hopper, but he's trying to communicate why such a forgery might succeed or fail. So if you like the artists that he has tasked the students with trying to mimic, you will definitely get something out of it. I have a Hopper calendar over my desk right now, so I definitely enjoyed the premiere. And as someone who can't even draw a stick figure, some of it just whooshes right past me, but it is processy, like Myatt's comments on composition and how the painting dictates to the viewer. And it's also very soothing. It's good, like, I don't know. It's actually good, like, trying not to barf TV, Dave. So after we get done recording, you should dial this up.
All right, I'm going to load it up right now as we talk about this podcast.
Yes.
Where is it, Sarah? It's on YouTube?
Yes, it is on YouTube.
Okay, we'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah, it only had one season, but they are a cinch to find on YouTube, and I don't think it's really, I think no one cares anymore, so even if it is, like, illegally posted, everyone be cool. But that is called The Forger's Masterclass, featuring John Myatt. And for my plug, The Blotter Presents is not to do with forgers this week, or with American Vandal, yet. That's next time. This time, Toby Ball of Crime Writers On and I are talking about RFK conspiracy theories, among other topics. So tune in. That should be available wherever fine podcasts are downloaded by the time you listen to this.
Hey, it's time for the canon, and Rolling Stone's chief number one emperor of television is presenting... This week, take it away, Alan.
All right. So when the Breaking Bad book first came out, I pitched a Breaking Bad episode. By all rights, I should probably be pitching a Sopranos episode this time to plug away some more, or at least talk about an episode of some other show that one of those two influenced. Instead, I want to talk about the show I've spent more time watching this year than any other, a show that should feel outdated in this era of intense serialization, moral complexity, anti-heroes, cinematic TV, blah, 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 but which held up spectacularly well 20-plus years later, ER. When Hulu added all 331 episodes of the show back in January, I figured I would sample a few for nostalgia's sake, then get back to 2018 TV critic business. But that didn't happen, because each episode made me want to see what happened next, and soon I binged nearly every episode of the first 8 seasons. This was one of my favorite shows for that stretch of its original run, because it hasn't been easily watched in so long, and because it's stylistically so different from most of what we consider quote-unquote quality TV today. It held up less well in my memory than it did when I was rewatching it all this year. It's a show that gets to have its cake and eat it too. At heart, it's a medical procedural, with a bunch of stories that are introduced and resolved within the course of the hour, so you always get a satisfying experience. But there are also character arcs about career and relationships that carry on for weeks or seasons or even the entire series. And frankly, when the world seems to be sinking into a bottomless moral pit, it just feels good to spend an hour at a time with characters who are trying to help people, even if some of them are kind of jerks. The episode I've chosen is Season 4's Exodus, which is my favorite example of my favorite type of ER episode, the mass casualty. In these stories where the emergency room is overwhelmed with victims of the same incident, two things inevitably happen. The pace of what was already a very quick show somehow speeds up even faster, and the chaos of the day results in characters being placed in unexpected situations and roles, demonstrating skills or emotional resources they didn't even know they had. Exodus starts out like a run-of-the-mill ER episode. Bad boy pediatrician Doug Ross and heroic nurse Carol Hathaway have started to reconnect after being on the outs for years, and she's helping him through this shift. Surgeon Elizabeth Corday is doing a paramedic ride-along, and the series' longtime point-of-view character, John Carter, isn't even working in the ER when the episode begins, though he'll be temporarily running the place before it's over. The episode does a nice job slowly walking us up to the mess that's soon to land on County General, focusing on Corday and the paramedics as they arrive at the scene of a chemical warehouse explosion. A worker named Leo is trapped under some rubble, and since Corday is a character on a network medical drama, that means she has to go against protocol to do everything she can to try to rescue him, which we hear a bit of in our first clip.
Dewey here. What the hell's going on?
Explosion in the chemical area. Abort and get out.
Acknowledge.
Capstan's out.
No, you tell him to bring that thing we need so we can get him out.
The captain's not going to let anyone come down.
Then you go get it.
And leave you.
Yes, they could let you back down if I'm here. Now go, I'm not leaving him. But hurry.
Okay, I'll be back.
We're going to die down here.
It's okay, Leo. Just one more piece of equipment, and we'll get you out.
Back at the hospital, a familiar assortment of cases begin to pile up, including pushy ER chief Kerry Reaver tending to a wealthy businessman complaining of mild chest pain, and Doug and Carol treating a little girl in renal failure. Carter is in the midst of an ophthalmology rotation where his patient is a Mr. Wizard wannabe, played by former number one movie star in the world himself, Mickey Rooney. When a group of chemical plant workers show up at the ER on their own, it's Rooney who first notes the smell of benzene they inadvertently brought in with them and warns Carter, which primes the young doctor to shortly save the day. Weaver suffers a debilitating seizure from benzene exposure, leaving the emergency room staff running around like chickens with their head cut off. In a situation where everyone is simultaneously trying to be in charge, no one is. And it's up to Carter, of all people, to step up and take charge, as we hear in our next clip.
She can't come in here. The ER's contaminated.
What happened?
They just showed up covered in benzene. Okay, someone clear out the lobby!
You didn't control the scene. They came in a pickup truck.
Move that gurney out of the way.
You need to move.
Just move.
Okay, somebody clear out the lobby.
We are going to evacuate the entire ER. Check every room. All contaminated patients and staff go to the ambulance bay right now.
Wait a minute, how do we know who's contaminated?
If you got a spot on your skin, if you got a spot on your gurney, if you got a spot on your clothes, go outside right now.
Now, what I love about Carter's role here is that he's not even being particularly super heroic, the way that the ER docs could sometimes get in these big spotlight episodes. He just happens to know slightly more about benzene than anyone else, and he recognizes that with Weaver out of action, someone has to make quick and sensible decisions, and he does that. Even Dr. Benton, long the mentor to Carter's protege, instantly gets that everyone needs to listen to one voice, and he falls in line. After Carter seizes control, it's a mad scramble to evacuate the ER, particularly once the hazmat team, led by, hey, it's that guy, Ed Lauder, shows up and orders everyone to hurry. Somehow, Carter manages to do it, even getting an elderly patient on a ventilator named Inga to pump her own oxygen bag while Carter wheels her to the temporary ER being set up in the cafeteria. Doug, meanwhile, being the charmingly insufferable cowboy that he is, decides his patient shouldn't go to the cafeteria, but straight upstairs, despite Carol and every other sensible human with an earshot telling him it's a bad idea, which we get a taste of in our next clip.
This is ridiculous. It's not going to work. There's not enough room.
You're going to be better off in the cafeteria.
No, I need you in the ICU. All right, let's pull the lines and close the circuit. Stop cranking so I can disconnect.
There's a liter of her blood in that machine, Doug.
Aware of that.
We should go to the cafeteria now.
Hang on. All right. Now they got a loop. All right, start cranking again. You come with me. You take the other elevator, meet us up at the PICU. Keep cranking. Don't let that blood clot. Let's go.
And shocker of shocks, Doug, Carol, and the girl get trapped in the elevator when the power temporarily goes out during the evacuation. From there, it's an escalating series of mini-crises. Doug nearly decapitates himself trying to get the elevator doors open. Corday just barely gets Leo into surgery in time, and Carter has to keep playing medical MacGyver to save lives under suboptimal conditions. In the midst of all this, poor Inga, who insisted she was strong enough to keep bagging herself while Carter and the others focused on younger and more critical patients, crashes and Carter doesn't make it up to the cafeteria until after his friend Dr. Delamico and Benton have failed to save her, which brings us to our next clip.
5 rounds of epi, 2 of atropine, lidocaine, Bertilium, amiodarone.
Should have had her up in the ICU.
Wouldn't have made a difference.
Might have.
No, you turn this place into an ICU.
This isn't an ICU. This is just something we threw together.
It's a touching moment and a nice example of how well ER could make you care about the death of someone you'd only just met and who literally didn't have a line of dialogue, all because she cared a couple of charming moments with a character we know and like in Carter. And the episode doesn't pause to grieve for very long, since the rich businessman immediately suffers a heart episode, and Carter has to improvise a save using 6 pitchers of ice water and a cafeteria dish tray. Again, Carter is heroic but not superhumanly so, and in some ways his most impressive moment of the whole episode comes at the end, when he leads a recovered Weaver and the rest of the staff into the decontaminated emergency room for our final clip.
Carter, I spoke with Harriet Spooner, the incident commander, and I would like to thank you for helping out. And the administration would like you to speak with the press. We'll meet them together in the first floor conference room at 11:15. Well, in terms of dealing with these people, I think I've had a little more experience. You know, it's important that the emphasis...
No, Morris gets that vent.
All right. It's important that the emphasis be placed on the institutional response to the crisis as opposed to any individual act, which they would tend to sensationalize. I think it's best to say simply that we followed a well-rehearsed disaster plan and worked in concert with the hazmat team to ensure the safety of our patients and also of the medical staff.
Carter, the fire captain would like to speak with you outside.
All right. 11:15?
That's right.
I'll be there.
What the podcast medium fails to convey is that even as Weaver the Credit Hog is lecturing Carter about not trying to claim too much glory for himself, he's scanning the entire emergency room to make sure all the patients are where they need to be, and all the other doctors and nurses are giving him thankful and approving nods. Carter doesn't need the public credit. He knows what he did, and so does the rest of the staff, and the lives they saved are all that mattered. When Dr. Green turns up at the end of the episode, Carter's first impulse isn't to brag about what happened earlier in the day, but to ask how Mark's ailing mother is doing. Both Carter and ER itself would get much darker and much smugger in the later years. But Exodus hits a sweet spot for both character and series in demonstrating all the things both could accomplish under absurd circumstances. It's exciting and sad and funny, and one of the best episodes of one of the best dramas ever made. I hope you'll consider it for the canon.
Can I go first? Since
sure.
I don't want to say very much because when what's her nuts right at the end was talking to Carter and she
Carrie.
Was sort of Carrie's like talking like that. I feel like I'm gonna have to talk not to throw up. So here we go. one thing that Alan didn't mention that makes this episode great is minimal Mark Green.
Yes,
yes.
In my notes.
He's literally there for like 30 seconds right at the end of the episode. So that's always a nice surprise when that happens. But the real reason this is such a great episode is exactly what Alan said right up top, which is you have a fast paced show and then you get into, which I can only assume was a sweep episode, where, you know, they have a mass cash and everything goes bonkers and everybody's got to deal with it. And
it was
it's just like the boink, the boink, the boink, the boink, the boink rhythm of it is like so watchable. Very, very, very watchable. The one thing that I thought was actually like just hilarious was like Mickey Rooney as Mr. Failed Wizard. It reminded me so much of the Star Trek Next Generation episode where they meet Scotty, who is, I forget, he was like working on a Dyson sphere and somehow he's now, you know, a couple centuries ahead and he's meeting. And it was like, you gotta listen to your elders because once in a while, once every 10 years, they have a good idea that could help you out. And it was exactly the same tone as this one. Like, oh, if we only listened to Mr. Wizard, you know, we could have stopped this. You know, kids respect your elders, the plot. One set note, the sort of collapsing tunnel structure that was at the start where You know, Leo's at the end of it, and the paramedics are trying to get to him. Right at the start, they say, you're going to have to go in head first. You know, there's no room to turn around. You have to crawl back the same way you walked in. They get there, and there's like room for a whole orchestra at the end of the tunnel. Like they're moving around. They're swapping places. They're juggling. Like they're throwing bowling pins to each other. Like if you're going to say that in the script, you got to like show it on the screen. Like it really was cavern. It was the most cavernous tight tunnel I ever did see. But that doesn't really take away from which is a very, very watchable, fun episode.
I'll go next. I didn't remember that Corday and Doug overlapped at all. So that was kind of a surprise. And I also forgot that she was with Benton at first, which better choice, just saying.
Yes.
Obviously. Yeah, I do like a mass casualty episode. And there was a lot to like about this one. That, you know, the way we heard it in the clip, the way the hysteria keeps mounting and the soundtrack is helping until there's the relief of someone just taking charge, even if, as you say, like, it's just everyone has to listen to one voice, whoever's voice it is. And, you know, this is a great moment for Carter, of course. And although it's dumb when he runs in and contaminates the decontamination episode and blah, blah, area, whatever. But I also didn't, I mean, to me, this wasn't like a super special episode of ER. It's like, it's definitely what they do well. But at the same time, when a show is this good for as long as it was good, I don't remember at what point I stopped watching, but it was in the 2000s. It's hard to identify like what makes this one a super standout despite your case. So I don't know. I'll also say this is from the era where Weaver was still like a kind of one note ball buster, which was not my favorite. I feel like over the years they got better at drawing her, and here, even as she's like barely standing and is still trying to control like the press conference, later Carrie would not be like that. So I don't know, maybe it's just that she evolved over the show, but this is not my favorite era of her. So I'll throw it to, although I did like the moment where the wealthy businessman, who by the way was recently also on 90210 in the episodes that we covered, as the guy who hires Brandon away to the New York Chronicle.
LOL.
The moment where Carrie has no memory of what happened around the time that she passed out, and he's like having to walk her through it while she's puffing on a thing.
That was in my notes.
It's very cute and endearing. But yeah, this was definitely a very watchable episode, but is it like in the upper 1% of ER episodes? I don't know. I'll throw it to you, Sarah.
It's in the first. I'd like to note that shockingly, we have only one other ER episode that's even been proposed for the canon way back like over 100 episodes ago. It is, of course, the Carter Gets Stabbed episode, or the aftermath, actually. And I don't know why episodes in which Carrie Weaver is vomiting keep rolling up for the canon. Thanks, Ellen. You're a peach.
You're welcome.
This, I immediately knew what this episode was. And not only that, but like to this day, anytime anyone mentions benzene, I'm like, I use Mickey Rooney's line that it's like, promise me you'll check it out. Like, I absolutely remembered this. I also had a major crush on Noah Wiley at this time. And this like floppy haired, shut up, coming into his own moment. Now Dave is definitely going to barf. This was like peak awesome Carter before like fentanyl and his, you know, Doctors Without Borders goatee period. This is also, I wasn't as anti-Mark Green as some, but this is also like peak divorced Mark goatee, like trying to quit smoking and doing it with Mariska Hargitay. And we didn't have any of that in this episode. It all just like passed right over us. So that was good. But this is definitely everything that makes ER ER, like the determined piling on of crises in the fourth act, like nonstop. A string of "Hey, it's that guys." You have Eva Mendes in her first, one of her first roles. You have Marshall Flinkman. He has like a line. You barely hear him talking. He's just being wheeled around. Ed Lauder, Mickey Rooney is not "Hey, it's that guy," but we'll count it. That son of a bitch,
Simone from Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's talk about your big butt.
And it's like I loved Anna Delamico. I was sad when she left the show. So this was great. The Clooney Margulies corner of this universe has not aged real well for me for a bunch of reasons that are not really worth getting into. And you can't
stop thinking about Batman. I get it.
Yeah. It's a problem.
It was interesting to see her see Juliana Margulies like stuck in an elevator and like getting jostled around, because like I haven't seen her be physically constrained in any way like that in so long. Like she certainly, you know, didn't have her mobility impeded on The Good Wife or on Dietland. So it's funny to see her like so much younger and so inconvenienced.
Yeah. Yeah. And with her actual hair, which was perfectly fine. But yeah, this was a very watchable episode, and Buncey's like mini criterion for canon inclusion is, did I just let Hulu roll into the next one? Even though it was a pretty Mark-centric episode? Yes, I did. Did I watch most of the episode? Yes, I did. So this was an excellent presentation. I take Tara's point. Like, this show was really on for a long time. But if you asked me to describe three ER episodes that did not involve a helicopter, this would be on the list for me, as it happens. I did remember this one. So yeah, good presentation. And let's see what the vote tells us.
All right. Before we put this to the official vote, I just want to say that, you know who loves Mark Green and idolizes him? I'm going to say Edward Snowden, because he really took all his fashion cues from him.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
All right. I went first, so I will vote first. And I say yes. I'm not as well versed in all things ER as you guys, but I watch my fair share. And this seems like a fantastic example of one of ER's strengths, which is the, you know, crazy mass cash episode. And I had a lot of fun watching it. Tara?
I'm going to vote no, just because it was so firing on all cylinders at this point, and I'm not sure for me this is a super standout, but it sounds like it does not matter.
You're correct. I am voting yes.
All right. That means... ER Season 4, Episode 15, Exodus. You are here by inducted into the extra hot great can of shush.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Who has our winner?
Me. And our winner is John Legend, the Creative Arts Emmys, formerly probably not anymore known as the Schmemmys, were this past weekend, the non-televised one, or like non-in primetime one. And John Legend was nominated for Jesus Christ Superstar Live, and he won, which means he is the youngest EGOT completer currently alive. So good job to him.
And loser of the week?
Well, our runner-up is runway-er-up, that is Bravo, because they got Project Runway back, and then Tim and Heidi ditched it to make their own show, and then Zach Posen, I think slightly before that, but possibly after / as a result, was like, bye. So
God damn it, if there's one thing I hate is people that get bought out by Bravo and then like leave right after. It's really fucking rude.
And not in an orderly fashion either, like a couple leave and then a couple more leave. Assholes. But that's not our actual loser. Our actual loser is Lech Moonves, who was going to get $100 billion retirement package. And then six more women came forward with harassment/assault allegations. And now he is just out, period. No money. Although they're keeping him on as an unpaid advisor. Who is he going to advise?
That's some contractual obligation thing. The lawyers can figure out how to get out of.
Right.
Yeah. Advise this.
Well, now we can forget about Les Moonves and invest heavily in the 30 Rock's Moonvest guy from the subway. Oh, I always enjoy it. Speaking about strange guys on subways, do you know what time it is?
Game time?
Yeah. I think I'm going to make it to the end, but just so you know, dear listener, if anything were to happen, I would have paused the podcast, taken care of business, and come back. So if you're like sitting there worried that something's going to happen on air, it won't. All right, game time. This is the first game time of the season. Last week was non-regulation. So first game time of the season, the world is once again full of wonder and opportunity. We are playing today another game from Mr. Dan Cancino.
Yay.
He earns himself an extra credit, redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of his choosing. And from now on until I say it's no longer happening, because I am pretty busy with other stuff. I don't watch a lot of new television. I am also offering extra credits. You forced me to watch something from my Around the Dial segment.
Hey, good idea.
Okay. So that is your choice, Dan Cancino. You can give us a mini topic or you can give me an episode of something I can easily find, you know, that's streaming, and I will watch that and report back on it for Around the Dial. So
you're really rolling the dice there, Dave.
Yeah, I know. I know. But I think it'll be fun. So before and thanks, after Sarah. Three, this is his third entry into the title mashup game time genre. I'll Excellent. Remind you how it goes. I will read the description of a TV show that's a mashup of two existing shows. So if I told you this show was nominally a comedy about an ESPN-like channel, but mostly consists of John Larroquette mansplaining legal concepts to Marky Post, you would know I was talking about
Sports Night Court.
Sports Night Court, correct.
I would watch the shit out of that.
Answer correctly, you get 1 point. No hints today, except to say that the in titles are sometimes tossed when the mashup title happens. So gotcha. Sometimes Got the it. is put into the trash. Tara, can you please tell us about the steel mill situation?
Yeah, this is easy. No one has any steel mills except Sarah D. Bunting, and she has six.
Oh, damn! Wow.
All right. So let's throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, let's make our order today. Sarah, Alan, Tara, are we ready to play before and after three?
Yes, yes. Sir.
All right, let's here we go.
Good luck, everybody.
Sarah D. Bunting, whoops, prequel to the classic novel Treasure Island about privileged pirates coping with life in prison.
Privileged pirates coping with life in prison?
Yes.
Orange is the New Black Sails?
Nice.
That's how you do it.
There it is.
Alan Sepinwall, numero uno head TV honcho at Rolling Stone. Superhero and his clones come out of retirement when his daughter is recruited by a gang.
Oh, superhero and his clones out of retirement. Daughter is recruited by a gang.
That's the mashup description. What's the mashup title?
I'm blanking on both of these. I'm sorry.
That is Orphan Black Lightning.
Wow.
Ah.
Oh, of course.
Yes. Hey, Ariano, here's your first question. Subterranean Muppets compete to impress aging rocker Bret Michaels.
Fraggle Rock of Love.
Ew.
It's extremely unwholesome, Dan.
Yeah.
Back to Bunty. Bunty? Yeah, sure.
Sure.
It's your new name, Bunty.
For today.
Jason Schwartzman and Ted Danson moved their detective operation to the gorgeous island of St. Marie, where they meet a closed-door mystery every week in this British procedural.
Oh, my God. What was the name of that goddamn thing?
Which one?
Any of them. In this British procedural?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Does anybody know the first part of that?
It's Bored to Death. Is it like Death in Corfu or something like that?
It's
Death on the Nile?
Nope. It's Bored to Death in Paradise.
Never would have gotten that.
Yeah, that was a tough one. Back to Alan. I know Alan's going to know half of this one, at least. Diagnosed with terminal cancer, a teacher moves in with a group of drunken, uncouth women so that appearances on the Oxygen Network will support his family.
Breaking Bad Girls Club?
Yeah, that's right.
Love it.
Abby Picky and Elena host an AE true crime show in which each episode is set in a different metro area.
Broad City Confidential.
That's a good one.
Nice.
Connie Britton and Angela Bassett deal with emergencies in orbit as the conflict between Cardassians and Bajorans escalates.
Deep Space 911.
Right.
Gorgeous.
Gory MTV claymation panel show in which Deborah Messing always gets the wrong answers.
Okay, Match Game. What the hell was
Gory MTV claymation panel show in which Deborah Messing always gets the wrong answers?
I got nothing on the claymation MTV.
That was Celebrity Death Match Game. All right, this is my personal favorite of the whole batch, so that is a little bit of a clue, I suppose.
Okay.
Mustachioed Vietnam vet in short shorts deals with the machinations and murder in the Roman Senate.
Wow. This is a show that should exist for you only.
Yeah.
Magnum P.I. Claudius.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Nice. Wow.
They call him Mr. Johnny Domino when he plays hot jazz on the streets of Sparta, Mississippi.
In the heat of the night, man. How is this not your favorite?
Nightman.
Thank you, Dan Casino. Oh.
An angel and his assistant help adolescent duplicates of historical figures recover their faith.
Clone Highway to Heaven.
Only a bipolar intelligence agent can see the true threat to America. Slee Stack Sleeper Cells.
Homeland of the Lost.
Homeland of the Lost, you're correct.
Would watch.
Judd Hirsch plays a mystical surfer dude so ponderous and inscrutable that his wife leaves him.
Dear John from Cincinnati?
Book adaptation in which the Sugar Bakers convene women from various branches of law enforcement to solve crimes together that they couldn't solve alone.
Designing Women's Murder Club?
Yes, sir. You are correct.
Wow. All right. Deep cut.
Also would watch.
Is our last question before the first score break. Jennifer Lopez and Derek Huff?
Yep.
Yep. Judge this reality competition in which escape theme park robots dance for $1 million prize.
West World of Dance.
West World of Dance. You are correct. And now, the scores, please.
Very close game. Alan has 3 points. Sarah has 4 points. I have 5 points.
Nice. All right. Well, in the interest of me of not vomiting and trying to read tiny print with very bright lights, let's move on. Cultures clash in this sitcom about Freddie Prinze running a business with Adolf Hitler in Nazi-occupied America.
Chico and the Man in the High Castle. Casino, you devil.
This is number 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
Full title of classic procedural in which Carl Malden and Michael Douglas bring in Baltimore criminals for intense interrogations.
Homicide: Life on the Streets of San Francisco.
Correct.
Little known spinoff.
Toronto vampire detective gets himself a talking Pontiac Firebird Trans Am.
Oh. Forever Knight Rider.
Yeah. You did it. This is question 19. Our feisty title investigator leaves Neptune and gets work for the Phoenix Foundation, solving problems with engineering and voiceovers. I'm going to give you a little clue. There's an extra, there's a day point in it for you if you say this correctly.
Hey.
Can you read the second part of the clue again, please?
I'll just read the whole thing for you.
Thank you.
Our feisty, titled investigator leaves Neptune and gets work for the Phoenix Foundation, solving problems with engineering and voiceovers.
Engineering and voiceovers? It's not Veronica Life on Mars, so I don't know what it is. No Dave point for me.
Oh.
Or other point.
Anybody want to take
MacGyver Veronica Mars.
MacGyver Veronica Mars.
That was a good hint, and I missed it. Sorry.
All right. TV version of film in which Gina Linetti and Rosa Diaz have had enough and take revenge on their sexist male superiors.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine to Five.
Yeah.
Would watch all of these.
And they're making a new series out of that, I read recently. Nine to Five is going to be.
Yes.
They're taking another crack at that as a TV show. Jerry Van Dyke finds that his mother has been reincarnated in a Depression-era traveling circus, an event which may end the world.
My mother, the carnival. No, thank you.
Peter, Lois, and Stewie, and their whole musical clan travel America telling everyone to come on and get happy. I thought it was happy, and then I couldn't read it. And I thought maybe it was hoppy. And then I had to check the answer and make sure it had nothing to do with rabbits, which it doesn't. There's an extra clue.
The Partridge Family Guy?
Yeah, the Partridge Family Guy is correct. Viola Davis leads this tutorial on how to beat a serial killer themed Fox reality show.
Fox reality show with murder title. One of them's How to Get Away with Murder, but...
How to beat a serial killer themed Fox reality show.
Serial killer themed Fox reality... How to Get Away with Murder in a Small Town.
Is that the complete answer?
That's the best I can do under the circumstances.
Best you can do is almost good enough, but not quite. How to Get Away with Murder in Small Town X.
Ah! I knew there was an X!
Yeah. Netflix revival of a classic sitcom in which a diverse cast has to fight a conspiracy by traveling throughout American history.
One Day at a Timeless. Fucking timeless.
I know.
Life on the Crowley's estate is upended with revival of a new heir, an uncouth former major leaguer played by Danny McBride.
I think you mean the Crowleys.
What'd I say?
Crowleys.
What did I say?
I was like, Aleister Crowley?
It's my southern accent.
I know.
I feel like we've had this one before, but I will take it. Eastbound and Downton Abbey.
Yeah, sure.
Nice.
All right. Most recent version of a classic story about an orphan in the Maritimes using stock footage, portentous voiceovers, and publicity interviews to populate celebrity narratives on a basic cable show.
I'm just having a bad day. I do not know any of the words that you said.
Yeah.
I think they're all English, but I got nothing.
All right.
I will steal this meal. I believe this is Anne with an E, True Hollywood Story.
Ding, ding.
That it is. Okay. When his family is murdered by serial killer Red John, a former fake psychic is forced to move in with his despicable Othario of a brother while he seeks revenge.
Oh, no. Now I can't remember. Oh, God. Thank God. 2.5 Mentalist.
Nice pull.
It was Mentalist. That title was so generic. Forgot it.
When Chandler moves to California, Monica leaves her job and medication in New York to follow so that she can rekindle a long ago crush.
Crazy ex-girlfriends?
At first, Gomez and Morticia didn't mind the wacky neighbor constantly hitting on their daughter. But as he took over the show, their thoughts turned to murder.
The Addams Family Matters?
Correct. All right, this question will take us into our score break. It is question 30 of 36.
Okay.
Recent Disney Channel hit about a songwriting duo navigating the changing workplace of the 90s, unisex bathrooms and all. Disney Channel.
Yeah, that's going to be no use difficulty. To me. It's something Ally McBeal, but I don't know. The only recent one I can think of is, I think, called Liv and Maddie. So I do not know.
Anybody
Austin
know?
And Ally McBeal.
Austin and Ally McBeal, yeah. Here's a guy who has kids.
Good job, Alan.
Yep.
All right, score break, please.
Well, it's very exciting. Alan has 6 points. Sarah and I are tied with 9 each.
Done. Okay. Done.
Here we go. Everybody's got 2 questions left.
Okay.
Melissa Joan Hart informatively answers all of Archie Bunker's presumably rhetorical questions.
Clarissa explains it all in the family.
Correct.
Nice.
Sasha Baron Cohen dresses up as an amnesiac? I can't be right.
Yep.
Yeah, that's no, right.
Christina Applegate to get politicians, mostly from the right, to do or say embarrassing things on camera.
Sarah, do you know the answer to this one by chance?
Do I?
Yeah, do you?
I think so.
Okay, then Dave, I have no idea whatsoever.
Don't do that to me. Just take it. It's fine.
Samantha, who is America?
You are correct.
What a gentleman also.
I know. And a scholar.
Well, I can't win, so I'm just trying to muck up the outcome because I'm a singer.
Sarah D. Bunting doesn't want your charity.
She does. She just wasn't totally sure of the title. So
I see.
I didn't want to waste his charity. He's the point.
Sure. I stand corrected. Okay. Needing childcare help, a family brings in a relative whose day job for the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement has ill-prepared him for dealing with children.
Oh,
United
no.
Network Command for Law and Enforcement has ill-prepared yeah. him for dealing with children.
I feel like half of it is the $6 million man, but I don't know about the child care.
I'm just going to buzz you in there right there.
Sarah?
Incorrect.
Oh, okay. Sarah, seal meal?
No, I don't know.
Alan, do you know what it is for Shiz and Giggles?
No, I do not.
That is the man from Uncle Buck.
Okay.
All right, everybody's last question heading your way.
Okay.
In the TV version of a world where everyone is killed when they hit 30, a group of teen finds out that their parents are supervillains and have to go on the lam.
Oh, no. Their parents are supervillains?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know what this is. I mean, the first one is Logan's Run, but then the second one is Logan's Running on Empty? I don't know.
Oh, so close, Sarah!
So close!
That is Logan's Run and Runaways, the Marvel teen super hero villain family thing.
Now I will know that.
A computer hacker hallucinates bad claymation spoofs of pop culture icons as he plots to bring down Evil Corp.
Okay, I think I know the answer to this one. Mr. Robot Chicken?
Mr. Robot Chicken. All right.
Nice.
And our last question of the regulation game. Yep. Based on a Stephen King novel, this show is pretty bad, and we're all dumber for having watched it. But at least in the last episode, we find out how everyone dies. Barbara, Big Jim, Jr., and the rest.
I feel like we've had this one before, too, but 6 feet under the dome.
6 feet under the dome is correct.
Oh!
Scores, please.
Well, Alan finished strong with 8 points. Sarah and I finished tied with 10 each.
Oh, no! My goodness. That means it's time for our tiebreaker. First person to shout out the correct answer after I read the entire clue, mm-hmm. will win today's game. Okay. Are you ready, Sarah D. Bunting?
Yes.
Are you ready, Tara X. Ariana?
Yes.
Good luck, Tara. Here we go.
The governor's butler finds his job complicated when his dad, a cartoon barbarian, decided to renew their relationship.
Ben Son of Zorn.
Ben Son of Zorn is correct.
Oh, I couldn't get
Tara
there.
Takes it.
Good job, Tara.
Tara! Tara.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We talked about a lot of things and had a lot of fun today, but let's talk about the real deal. I made it through without barfing. And for that, we can all be thankful.
Dave.
Thank you so much.
Congrats to us all.
Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
also keeping control of my GI tract,
Sarah D. Bunting.
Everyone knows ukulele. God damn it. Pretend I'm not here.
And Alan Seppenwall.
I'm just glad nobody barfed.
Me too. Me too. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Yellow is for the bumblebee. Going buzz, buzz, buzz.
This dude, Eric, got stung once on his nut. And it swelled up, and we had to put a special sock around it.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.